Does the Bible hate women? That's a question that sometimes wondered when you read stories in the Bible that seem to marginalize women, treat them as property, and undervalue them as a whole. And this isn't simply a question about what does the Bible say. It's often because of the experiences that women have felt being a part of churches for centuries. And so today on Whiskey in the Writings, we're going to look at the question, does the Bible really hate women? And we're going to look at some areas that might surprise you in the Bible about where God lands on this subject. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get started. All right, today on Whiskey in the Writings, we are drinking once again Heaven Hill. This is a special glass of whiskey on a special episode, one that I'm passionate about. What does the Bible say about women? And so we're drinking Heaven Hill, and this is a very sharp whiskey, so I've had it out resting, breathing, so that it'll just bring it down a little bit. But otherwise, once you let this thing rest, it is absolutely delicious. I've talked about it on other videos, but that's what we're drinking today. I've got my Whiskey in the Writings glass. I hope you've got yours. Pour your drink. Take a sip. Let's dive in. We are talking about a subject that can be polarizing, and it can be emotional because it deals with people, particularly people that can tend to be marginalized in Christian circles or even in religious circles, and those people are the women. And so I want to look at today, first off, what does the Bible have to say? Does the Bible really hate women? Or is there something else going on? And the real quick answer to that is no, right? The Bible doesn't hate women. Now, it has a lot to say about women, and we're going to unpack some of those things. Today's going to be very high level. In future videos, we're going to unpack a little bit further about this subject, and I'm excited to get into that with you in future videos. But for today, we're going to keep it super high level and really just unpack three things I want you to consider when it comes to how the Bible treats women. This isn't to say how religious people have treated women. This isn't to say how the church has treated women. This isn't to say in history how have women been treated. This is to say, what does the Bible present as a way to think about the role of a woman, at least in Scripture? And I am certainly, as a man, don't have any real firsthand knowledge of what it means to live as a woman in our world. What I can do, though, is hopefully unpack how God may see women in his story that he's telling, which is what we call the Bible. And so the first place we want to look at is a place that I've talked about quite a bit on Whiskey in the Writings already, and that's Genesis, particularly Genesis 1. And in this story, we see a setting of a stage. If you want to go back and see what Genesis chapter 1 is all about, we can link to that in the show notes. But here we have the perfect ideal of the way in which God created all things. And that's Genesis chapter 1, and it's verse 27. And this is what it says in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. Then God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Okay, so I'm reading out of the NET translation, the New English translation, and that's how it's heard. If you have the NIV in front of you, it'll read the same. If you have the ESV in front of you, it's actually going to read different. And for more on those differences and why it's important to read it for what it's read it more accurately, at least in the translation that I have, versus like what the ESV might have. I've written about that, and I can share that in the show notes, where you can learn a little bit more about the differences between Adam and Ha'adam and why that matters in this text here. But what's happening here is that if you're reading the word man instead of mankind or humankind, you're misreading it in the sense that it can imply that this is saying a male singular human being, which it's not. What the text is actually saying is that in the beginning, God created the humans, humankind, and he made that humankind in a gendered difference, okay? And so male and female, he created them. And so humanity, mankind, is made in a gendered male and female, and that's what God designed. And so these two peoples are created with a distinction that is not given to any other created thing before the humans, and that is the distinction of being made in the image of God. Now, this is a huge distinction, because what it does is it sets up for us right out of the gate that male and female are equal in their image-bearing identity and the very makeup of who they are. They bear within them the markup of what it means to be an image bearer, just like the man. And I don't know of any real scholar that would disagree with that. But at the beginning here, we need to set the stage. When we talk about how does God see women, how might God view women, this is the foundation to any theology you want to build around. It has to be cemented right here in that male and female together, they both inhabit the image-bearing reality of what it means to be a human being. And so there's, right out of the gate, equality, an equitable sharing of the image-bearing reality that we all have. And so I just want to set the stage with that reality, is that Genesis 1 verse 27 sets the trajectory of how we ought to see women going forward. Now, there are lots of crazy, terrible stories in the Bible in the abuse of women and how women are treated, for sure. But let's not confuse the stories about how humans have treated women versus how God sees and treats women, okay? And so that's right out of the gate. The next place we need to go when we need to understand how does God view women, the reality is that we've got to look at Jesus, okay? So for a Christian that is pretty much a Reformed Christian, comes out of the Reformed tradition, Jesus is the pinnacle of God coming into the earth, inhabiting flesh to become for us the example of what it means to then come into relationship with God. That's a big sentence to basically say, to answer the question of how God views women in Scripture, we need to look at Jesus. And so we're going to spend some time looking at how Jesus treated women, because if we truly believe, which I do, that Jesus is God, and that he represents the values of God here on earth by his life and his ministry, then the best place to look at how God might view women is Jesus himself. And I hope that logic makes sense. So we're going to look at two examples here in this next set. It's going to be pre-resurrected Jesus and post-resurrected Jesus. So we're going to look at how Jesus himself treated women, and then we're going to look at how Paul treated women in light of the resurrection. And before you get worried and scared, I'll have a little footnote at the end of this to clarify some thoughts that you may be having. But first, we're going to start with a biography of Jesus. And what that biography is written by a guy named Luke, who was a companion of Paul. And Luke didn't simply write a biography of Jesus. He also wrote a history of the church as it began to form in the first century. And so you have Luke, Acts, and these are writings that are meant to go together. One talks about the life of Jesus, one talks about the life of the church, and it highlights a guy named Paul, who Luke was a companion of. And so we get a lot of information about Paul. And so to look at pre-resurrection and post-resurrection, we're going to look at Luke and Acts. We're going to look at one guy's perspective on how Jesus treated women before his death and resurrection, and then how did the church, the leaders of the church, treat women after his resurrection, okay? And that's not anything to say about much later church traditions, second, third, fourth, all those. Those are all conversations that can be had. For now, we're gonna look at these two areas. So I made that point hopefully pretty clear. So we're gonna start in Luke, and we're not gonna look at all the stories, but here's an observation you need to know about the biography according to Luke. As he features Jesus. Luke, more than any other gospel, features more women in his gospel than any other gospel writer. Luke is like the pro-women gospel. He's talking about women everywhere. For instance, in the two birth narratives of Jesus, which we have in Matthew and Luke, Mark doesn't mention the birth story and John doesn't mention the birth story. But in Matthew and in Luke, they both tell the story of Jesus' coming. Matthew barely makes a blip of Mary, his mother, and talks a lot about Joseph and the experience that Joseph had, okay? Whereas Luke talks a little bit about Joseph, but mostly emphasizes Mary. And this sets the trajectory of Luke. Luke is very much pro-women. Another thing that you see in Luke, and that's not to say that the others are not, okay? So let's stop there. I'm not making an accusation that the other biographies are anti-women. I'm just saying Luke, for whatever reason, features more women in his telling of Jesus's life than the other biographies do. Another feature that you find out in Luke's gospel that you don't get in the other gospels is that we learn that it's women widows who are financially supporting the ministry of Jesus. So Jesus's ability to be a preacher that goes from town to town, going from place to place, how does he eat? How does he buy things? How does he replace the sandals? How did the disciples get more clothing when they wear out? All these things are because of the generosity of women who are supporting his ministry. And so these are details that you get in Luke's gospel that you don't get in any other of the gospels to the degree that Luke tells us this. And so here is another key thing that we see in the way that women interact with Jesus that gives us a clue as to how Jesus perceived and received women in his ministry. We're going to look in Luke, and we're going to look at chapter 10. And so if you have your Bibles open, go ahead and find chapter 10. Luke is your third biography that's going to be at the beginning of your New Testaments. While you're turning there, I'll take a sip. Okay, so Luke chapter 10, verse 38, we have this story. I'm going to read the story, then we're going to make some observations about the story. This is how the story goes. Now, as they went on their way, Jesus entered a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him as a guest. She had a sister named Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he said. But Martha was distracted with all the preparations she had to make, so she came up to him and said, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work alone? Tell her to help me." But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is needed. Mary has chosen the best part. It will not be taken away from her." Okay. You might have heard this story before, you know, busy Martha and Mary, and like, you know, teachings have been given on this. There's a couple of things that you need to do with this story. There are two areas that you need to highlight in your Bibles. The first area that you need to highlight is verse 39. She had a sister named Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he said. Now, this can go overlooked when we read it because we simply don't understand the implications of what Mary's doing in a story like this. So, you know, it's no big deal in our generation for women to be a part of conversations in a household, okay? And it's almost assumed in our generation. Like, can you imagine anyone, you know, telling the women, you know, this is, I mean, I guess we can imagine back in what, the 50s and the 40s and the 30s when it was like women get in the kitchen. Yeah, terrible, absolutely terrible. So maybe we can't imagine a world where this is important. But know this, in an ancient culture that patriarchy reigns supreme, and in Judaism where being at the feet of someone and listening to the teaching of someone indicated the rabbinic influence and authority that someone has over you. So to put it plainly, for Mary to sit at the feet of Jesus and listen to his teachings meant that Jesus was her rabbi. And in turn, Jesus had no problem being her rabbi and teaching her. This is what it says. Verse 42 is what you need to underline next. But one thing is needed. Mary has chosen the best part. It will not be taken away from her. Mary has chosen to submit herself under the discipleship of Jesus. Okay, let's put it even more plainly. Mary was a disciple, sitting at the feet of Jesus, just like the other disciples, listening to the teachings of Jesus, just like the other disciples. And when Martha got upset because she wasn't helping in the kitchen like she was supposed to, Jesus said, don't take this away from her. This is exactly where she needs to be. So what we see out of here is Jesus, and there's so many other examples we can give, and we don't have time. I encourage you to read the biography of Luke through fresh eyes, looking for all the stories that women are highlighted, like this one, where they are encouraged to sit at the feet of Jesus and learn from him and grow from his teaching and be discipled by him. So Jesus valued women, right? He valued Mary's devotion and actually put her into a place that in this tradition was typically reserved for men alone. So that's significant. That's powerful. And people reading this in this culture, I can only imagine the implications of experiencing this. One, as a disciple, seeing Mary there and seeing Jesus value her being there. And also later on, as traditions continued to grow and to see a story like this and the amount of encouragement it must have given women, as I hope it gives you today as you pursue Jesus in your life. So the second thing is this. Okay, so women, right, they're a part of Jesus' life pre-resurrection. He includes them. They follow him. They learn from him. They're a part of his ministry. The second question that we can look at is, what did it look like after Jesus' life, death, and resurrection? How did the early church begin to see women in the experiences that they had developing and growing the church? And the best place that we can look at that is Acts. Again, Luke here is continuing the story, and he's telling us about how the church was formed and grew. A couple key elements here that I want to point out, just like I did with Luke before we get into the main text. Luke also highlights on the day of Pentecost, who was in the upper room, Mary, Jesus's mother, and his family were up there. So right out of the gate, women were involved in the collection and then the launching of the church, where the day of Pentecost comes and the Spirit is poured out upon them. And women are there. They're a part of that. And so women are included in the birth and the launch of the church. And then this reality of women being included is actually solidified by Peter's sermon that he gives. If you go back in Acts and you read this long sermon, Peter actually quotes a specific verse in Joel, the prophet Joel, chapter 2. And in this Joel chapter 2, Joel makes a prophecy that Peter takes and applies it to the moment that they're experiencing. And in the prophecy, it says that men and women will have visions and dreams and will prophesy. And so women are included in the outworking of God's kingdom post-resurrection, from being in the room and a part of the prophetic fulfillment, according to Joel chapter 2, that Peter uses to communicate what's actually happening. This ought to be an encouragement to any women to see that God intends to use you, that God will use you, and that God had always planned to use you. But that's not my point for this. All right, let's look at another example through the life of Paul. Again, Paul's super controversial when it comes to this topic. How did Paul see women in ministry? Well, according to Luke's account, Paul had a high view of women being partners with him in the ministry of leading churches. And we see this everywhere, okay? One particular place I want to point us to is through a couple, a married couple, who's Aquila and Priscilla, okay? So Aquila is the husband, Priscilla is the wife. And their story is recorded in Acts chapter 18, but they're also mentioned in other letters that Paul writes. And so they're a significant couple in the ministry of Paul, and they actually accompany Paul. So there was a period of time where this couple followed Paul around doing ministry, and then Paul refers back to them in other letters. One thing you need to note about this is that there came a time where this married couple came in contact with a guy named Apollos, and that story is recorded in Acts chapter 18 and verse 24. And I want to read the story to you, and then I want to make a couple observations about it. All right, so this is how it goes. Now a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, arrived in Ephesus. He was an eloquent speaker, well-versed in the scriptures. And that word scriptures is the Old Testament, or what we call the Old Testament. It's the scriptures. They didn't have a New Testament at this time, so it couldn't have been. He was well-versed in the New Testament. It was all Old Testament stuff. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and with great enthusiasm, he spoke and taught accurately the facts about Jesus, although he only knew the baptism of John. And so this is an indication that he was baptized by John, the cousin of Jesus, but he knew Jesus and his teachings really well. And this is what Luke's saying is like, and he actually taught it pretty accurately. Okay, so far Apollos is pretty good dude, right? Seems he's an energetic. He might be that lively, you know, preacher that gets a lot of clicks and a lot of views, that kind of thing. And it goes on to say this: he began to speak out fearlessly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained the way of God to him more accurately. So here we have this guy who's well-versed, that's been established. And then when Aquila and Priscilla hear him teaching, they pull him aside and they're like, hey, these are essentially what it sounds like they're doing is they're correcting some of his theology. They're going, hey, this or that and this or that, okay? So harmless story, right? On the surface, you go like, oh, that sounds great. So why is this significant to our conversation? Well, did you notice in verse 26, it says, he began to speak out fearlessly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him. Okay, why does that matter? All right, so Aquila is the guy, Priscilla is the female, right? And in this statement, there's a swapping of the arrangement of names. Priscilla, the female, comes first to Aquila, the male. So it's his wife who's leading this. Now, why is this significant? Well, in the ancient world, one, we know through the historical evaluation of this era in a patriarchal society, women were secondary to men. And yet, Luke names her first. This is an act of priority for Luke. Luke is trying to get us to see that Priscilla is taking the lead role in the ministry along with her husband. Now, that's right here in Acts chapter 18. But what's interesting is that out of the instances that this couple is named, there's six times that this couple is named in the New Testament, all right? Four out of the six times, Priscilla is listed first, then her husband, Aquila. The two times where it's the husband first and then the wife is in a greeting that Paul gives where he says, hey, tell them I say hi, and an introduction to who they are, all right? Four out of the six times Priscilla is mentioned first and her husband's mentioned second. Out of those four times that Priscilla is mentioned first, it's all in a ministry context. Okay, so follow me on this, guys. This is huge. Luke is telling us a story, and then Paul writes about them later, all right, this ministry couple. Every time that this couple is brought up in light of ministry, Priscilla's mentioned first. The other two times that they're brought up, it's through the lens of a greeting or an introduction, which has nothing to do with ministry. So why does Luke do this? Unless she was the leading agent in the ministry of them together. Okay? Now, this is just what it is, right? This is where we stand with this conversation. All throughout Acts, you get stories about a businesswoman named Lydia when Paul goes to Philippi and begins a church there. It's Lydia who opens up her home and welcomes them in and begins to start a church in her home. Like these women play huge roles in the launching of the church, and it's only until later on in church history that their voices begin to be silent. And so I want to end with this. You might say, Joe, okay, that's all fine and well. Sure, we see lots of women active in certain ways through Jesus's ministry and in the life of Paul. But Paul also says that women should be silent, that if they have questions, they should go home and ask their husband, that they aren't allowed to be in leadership positions, that only men can do that. So what about those verses? Okay, I don't have enough time to discuss all the intricacies. I will. Stay tuned. But I don't have the time to do all that here. Here's what I will say. When you're reading the words of Paul in later letters, you always need to measure that against the activities that we see in his ministry. Here's what I mean by that. If Paul, in his ministry, like in Acts, is involving and including and referencing and working alongside women left and right, and he has no problem with Priscilla talking to Apollos leveraging women in his ministry in different capacities, then whatever he's saying later on in his letter, personal letter to his closest friend, ought to be read through the lens of how he lived his life. And if there's a discrepancy, well, why does it seem, Paul seemed okay for women to be a part of churches and leading churches in this capacity, but then here he says no? Okay, we ought to read it through the lens of his historical understanding versus the letter. So my argument would be this. We're misreading what he's saying in his letter. Okay, we're misunderstanding what he's trying to communicate to Timothy or to the church in Corinth. And we need to look at Paul through the lens of how Luke talked about him in Acts versus referring back to it. So that's what I'll say about that. In the future, we'll have another video, I'm sure, about Paul, women, Corinthians, and Timothy, and Titus, and we'll see where we go with that. But for now, I hope that you can see at least a starting point, a launching point to see that God uses women, will continue to use women. God's Spirit is poured out on women, and that they will prophesy, and that they will continue to lead in the church, because God has made us co-equals in our human and vocation identity as image bearers of God the Creator. And so that's my encouragement to you. Does the Bible hate women? No, it does not. Just the opposite. That's all I have for this video here. I hope you've enjoyed Whiskey in the Writings. If you have, please like, subscribe, share this video if you think it might be helpful for someone that's struggling with this question. Make a comment below. Let's engage online together. Love to hear your feedback, good, bad, or any of it. So here to chat. God bless you. And until next time, we'll see you on Whiskey in the Writings. Cheers.